I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about education in Indiana. We'll talk about the struggles between State Superintendent of Public Instruction Glenda Ritz and the State Board of Education, about school grades, and about the impact of Tuesday's elections on our schools. My guest will be Scott Elliott, Founding Bureau Chief of Chalkbeat Indiana. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimitswfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Or you can locate us on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the statehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the state of education in Indiana. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guest is Scott Elliott, who is the founding bureau chief of Chalkbeat Indiana. He's also an award-winning journalist who has covered education for more than 18 years. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you here. We're going to start a little bit by talking about what Chalkbeat Indiana is. I think that would be of interest to folks.
Sure. So it's a new website. We're just a little bit over a year old. We're based in Indianapolis, and we're nonprofit. We're philanthropy funded, and our goal is to provide high-quality independent journalism covering education with a heavy focus on low-income communities and efforts to make educational change.
And you've mentioned you're part of a national network.
Right? Yeah. So Chalkbeat is currently in four states. We're in New York, we're in Colorado, we're in Tennessee, and Indiana.
How did they select those four states?
Well, it was originally two independent sites in New York and in Colorado that merged because they were often asked if they would expand to other states. And I knew actually knew both the founders through my work. You know, I'm also the president of the Education Writers Association. And so I knew them through my work, and when I started talking with them about what they were doing, I said, well, if you want to be in states where things are interesting and where the state really matters in the national conversation on educational change, I mean, like, Indiana would be a place to be. And ultimately, they agreed, and they found some funding support here, and so here we are.
And you make the point there that Indiana is sort of ground zero for a lot of these discussions about all sorts of education policies, vouchers, you name it. I mean, we have the most expansive voucher program in the country. You know, was it a hard sell to get them to come here, and how have things worked?
It was not a hard sell. Their biggest question when I raised the idea with them was whether there was enough philanthropy activity in the education space in Indiana to support it. And I told them I thought there would be. There's, you know, of course, as I'm sure you know, this is a really good philanthropic community. Mm-hmm. A lot of public interest out there in the foundations and in the individuals who support Indianapolis and the wider state. So that's worked out really well. The hardest thing for us is just sort of getting people to find out about us, know what we do. We are forging partnerships with other media organizations. For instance, FYI, we've done some partnered events with WFYI. Mm-hmm. Also, the Indy Star and the Indianapolis Business Journal have picked up some of our stories. We are unique in the media space in that we really are not a competitor to commercial media. We view ourselves as a potential collaborator with other media. So that is a way for us to fulfill our mission and get people to read our content.
Well, we probably ought to talk a little bit. We just had this thing called an election here in Indiana, which had some implications. I mean, what were your takeaways from Election Day here in Indiana?
So Indiana, of course, politically, I think, is a really interesting place. Education is one of those weird issues where The various dividing lines don't always match to political parties. So, for instance, some folks were asking me yesterday, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, the state house became more Republican this term, which surprised some people. It already was strongly Republican with super majorities for the Republicans in both.
Yeah, now they're super majorities.
Really super majorities.
Yeah.
So people asked me, you know, what does that mean? And I said, interestingly, here, because they have so many Republicans in the legislature, the Republican Party is not monolithic about education. There's a lot of different camps within the party with different ideas about how the government should interact with education. So people ask me, like, now they have so many, like, will they just push forward with a really big agenda or make some kind of massive change in the state? I'm like, well, they got to look inside and see what they have support for within their party. So I think that will be interesting to watch to see what issues come to the surface and how aggressively the Republicans push various parts of their various agendas from within the party.
What do you expect to see?
For sure, school funding. The Republicans in the House have already signaled that that's something they're interested in. I find that issue here to be very interesting. Whereas many other states are primarily funded, schools are really funded in most states at a really local level. So it's local property taxes going directly to the local school. Some amount of state aid is mixed in, but really it's very often, like, well, I came here from Ohio, like Ohio, you're often having local elections to raise money for the schools. So we don't really see much of that here. This is a state where they've always, or for some time, they've funded schools via the state budget. So with sales tax and income tax and all the things that go into the state budget.
And with a really complicated school funding formula, too.
Now, that's true everywhere.
Yeah.
School funding is very complex. So here's the interesting debate that I think we'll have in the state house this year. You know, there's a question of The key question is, how do you make funding fair? And it's just a super hard question. It's so hard that really you couldn't go to any state in the country where they would say, hey, we got to figure it out. Our system's fair. Everybody has a gripe with the funding system. Here, the big divide is between suburban districts who get less than the wealthier, more suburban districts typically get a little bit less per pupil state aid than poorer, often larger or smaller rural districts get higher per pupil amount. And the question is, what difference between those kinds of districts is fair? And that's what I think we're going to hear a lot of discussion about and how big that divide should be. Everyone pretty much agrees there should be extra money that goes to support poor children and their education. The question is, how much is the right amount? How much extra? And how much can we afford? Those are the two factors.
We are talking about the state of education here in Indiana on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. And I should say that this show is part of American Graduate, an initiative funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. American Graduate shines a spotlight on the policies and practices that help children achieve success from their earliest preschool days through high school graduation and then to transition to college and careers. You can learn more at americangraduate.org. Well, you'd mentioned that this is not monolithic, that the divisions move across partisan lines to some degree. They break down within that. Given that now, at least at the legislative level, really the Republican Party is the only game in town. Mm-hmm. What divisions do you expect to see within those caucuses?
So there's all sorts of interesting camps within that party. Like, for instance, we saw it here in 2013 on preschool. So there's what you might call the business wing of the Republican Party in Indiana is very strongly pro-preschool in terms of some level of greater public support for preschool. You see that from large corporations here in Indianapolis, for instance. So there's sort of that part within the Republican Party. But then there's a whole other part that's sort of skeptical of whether an expansion of public spending on preschool takes the government a step deeper into your family life. Mm-hmm. You know, whether there are some folks who wish there was a way to make it so that children in all families get a high-quality preschool education at home, who believe that's preferred. So those are two really strong-held feelings within the Republican Party that are very diametrically opposed to each other. So that's just one example of an issue where you might think, you know, the governor here is very supportive of preschool, and yet he turned down some federal aid, largely
$80 million worth. Yeah.
Well, a share of $80 million, but certainly, you know, multi-millions that the state could have received. And he was pretty clear in saying he turned that federal grant down because he worried about federal intrusion into sort of preschool policymaking at the state level. That resonates with the sort of non-business side that I just described. You know, but the pro preschool business crowd within the party was pretty unhappy about that. So that's it's funny how people often think like a party gets control and they get to do whatever they want, but whatever they want means different things to different people. It's interesting how that happens.
Well, and we just did a show, actually, where we were talking about the effect of supermajorities. And one of the things that came out of that is that when you have one party that has such an overwhelming dominance, to some degree, the thinking is that the loyal opposition begins to emerge within that caucus, that it begins to divide into factions just mm-hmm. because it is so big. You know, and speaking to your point, I'm thinking of what I thought was a really telling exchange in a legislative committee a while back when they were talking about expanding still more the state's voucher program. And Luke Kenley, who's sort of the chair of the Senate finance operation, was asking Bob Boehning, who's a representative and all of that, shouldn't we kind of wait to see if these things are working? And, you know, Boehning's arguments seem to be, well, no, this is a parent's entitlement to some degree. It speaks to exactly the kind of issue you were talking about, is who ultimately is going to have responsibility for education.
So private school vouchers is another great example of those sorts of divides on the right. So there's a camp within the conservative movement in the U.S., that is very free market purist, mm-hmm. and so they would sign on to Milton Friedman's original argument, which many people have viewed as a presage to vouchers, which is that we should just give a dollar amount per student to every family, and then let that family choose where that child goes to school and not limit them. It's sometimes compared to the way we do colleges with, for mm-hmm. instance, Pell Grants. Mm-hmm. We will give federal grant money to a student, and they can take it anywhere. They could take it to a religious school, a non-religious, a public, a private, whatever. So that's one kind of point of view on it. But then there are folks within the Republican Party, though, who think that that's a little too far. Like, they don't want to dismantle the public education system we have. They're often very happy with their own public school system in the cities they live in. But they like the idea of people having options if, for whatever reason, they prefer a private school, maybe for a religious reason, or it's just a better fit for that child. So there are people in the camp who believe that that's a maybe more limited way. And then, of course, the voucher opponents believe that this is a dangerous walking of the line between the church-state divide. You know, if you're now directly funding, in some cases, you know, we have some private schools, some religious schools taking large amounts of money from the state. The mm-hmm. majority of their budgets now are coming from state dollars. You know, is that getting over the line between church-state divide? So it's interesting how those camps sort of break down.
We are talking about the state of education here in Indiana on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, we've talked about some of the divisions. How big a fight do you think there's going to be about the school funding
issue? I think that's going to be the issue of the legislature, because you know, everyone is worried about what they can lose. You know what I mean? So
it also hits that rural urban split too.
It will divide the three kind of main types of districts we have in the state are rural, suburban, and urban districts,
yeah.
And they will all retreat into a different camp and worry about whether it's their ox that's going to get gored.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think my colleague Leslie Weidenbender pointed out that whenever they're talking about school funding, you can literally see the legislators pulling out their cell phones and calling the local superintendent, yeah. and say, how is this going to affect us back home?
That was a great column by Leslie. And I know I know the legislators are nervous about it. I know that they nervous might be too strong a word, but I should say they're very aware that this is going to be a potentially emotional debate, and so there's going to probably be some level of effort to sort of try to explain where everybody's coming from, explain what they see as the problems in the system now, and how to fix it. At their core, there's a couple of big issues. One I mentioned earlier, which is how much more do you get for educating a poorer child who has mm-hmm. greater need. But the suburban districts have a really legitimate worry, too, which is many of them have been very limited and for a long time, so that hurts their budgets as well.
We are talking about the state of education in Indiana. My guest is Scott Elliott, who's the founding bureau chief of Chalkbeat Indiana. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the state of education in Indiana. My guest is Scott Elliott, who is the founding bureau chief of Chalkbeat Indiana. Before we went to the break, we were talking sort of about what kind of dispute, argument, debate, even fight there's going to be about the school funding formula. And we talked about some of the divisions. Didn't really talk in part because the Democrats now are in such a, I'm not sure you can even use the term super minority, but the fact that on the House side, they've only got 29 out of the 100 votes in there. And on the Senate side, they've got, what, 10 seats left, if I'm not mistaken, out of the 50.
Yep.
What role are they going to have, if any, in this process?
Well, I certainly think they'll have a role. Democrats, most of their constituents are in the very kinds of districts that benefit from some of that extra poverty aid. So mm-hmm. urban and small rural districts are, I think, in Indiana more likely to be represented by Democrats where there are Democrats. So I think that they'll be protective of those kinds of districts, and they will be worried about the impact on high poverty children if there's not enough money to educate those kids. The question is, you know, they certainly have a strategic question on the table in terms of how they approach this so that they can have their voices can be heard and they can impact decision making. That's a little bit harder mountain for them to climb. But I don't think that this will go on without the Democrats playing some role.
And we probably, if you're talking about education in Indiana, you really have to talk about the tug of war that's been going on for the past couple of years between the state superintendent of public instruction and the state board of education, to some degree the governor as well.
Mm-hmm.
Could you sort of give us a summary of what has happened up to this point in that drama? And then and then we'll go from there and dig into the weeds.
Well, let's start with Glenda Ritz's fascinating and I would say historic upset of Tony Bennett in 2012. It was very unexpected. She was massively outspent, but she ran a very smart campaign. She relied heavily on other educators. Of course, she's a teacher and at the time was working as a school librarian. She activated various networks of educators and had them activate their networks of friends and family in order to turn out a vote for herself. That was very effective. But she did sneak up on, I would say she snuck up on us in 2012. So she was not sneaking up on anybody anymore. And over the last 2 years, the governor and his appointees on the state board have gotten increasingly aggressive in trying to limit her influence on education policy. There's a genuine disagreement between Glenda Ritz and Governor Pence on how education policy should be enacted in this state, and that just makes it hard. When the two main policymakers in the state just totally disagree about how policy should be enacted, it makes it harder to get things done.
And where are things right now?
It's there were times in the last year where it was flat out open hostility. I don't think it's quite that bad today, but it's not that much better. I mean, so in the Bennett era, for instance, state board meetings typically lasted 2 to 3 hours. It was an unusual meeting that went beyond 3 hours. So I now go over to the state board meeting planning to be there all day. So yesterday's state board meeting was 6+ hours, and it's slowed down by a lot of debate and sometimes acrimony over very small issues about, you know, which side of the fence is doing their job and are they doing it correctly and is everyone keeping each other informed, and somewhat tiresome small debates about process. So that's not a great place to be when you're trying to create policy and trying to effectively manage the education apparatus of the state.
We've gotten, looks like a Facebook message from a listener named Mary Ann. And if you'd like to reach out to us via Facebook, you can do so and find us at No Limits WFYI. She says, after the approval of the delayed A to F grades yesterday, the new Indy Grade Schools school chooser guides are already obsolete since they were printed with the old grades. Can you explore effects or reasons for this?
It's so frustrating. Yeah. So the Grade Schools is an organization based in San Francisco that does school sort of directory information and in some cases ratings. And if you can look up test scores and parent reviews of schools, et cetera, on their website. What they've done in Indiana is something they've done in a couple other states where there's a lot of school choice is they create an actual paper guide, because a real problem that's occurred in Indianapolis and in some other cities is that when you get a lot of choice options in a city for parents, it's not easy to navigate those options. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really hard to know. Like, I still meet parents every, you know, all the time who don't really know what a charter school is, for instance, you know.
Well, we probably ought to actually take a moment and explain that, because my guess is a couple of those folks are listening.
That's very true. you know, a charter school is a public school, but it is run independently. So it can sort of feel like a private school, but there's no tuition, and it's subject to all the same rules of I shouldn't say all the same rules, most of the same rules of a traditional public school. And then, of course, we have the voucher program here, so you can also take state aid and pay private school tuition with that. So the guide is supposed to help parents navigate that process with giving them a lot of information on schools. How to time that guide has been difficult. I mean, I think it first came out in February, and the feeling was that was not timed very well to when parents mm-hmm. might need it. So they aim to do it at the fall this time. Mm-hmm. But then it means missing the latest test scores and A to F grades. So I think they're still trying to figure out how to make that work so that it times better and has as much accurate and up-to-date information as possible. The good thing about it is you can always go to the web's, you know, Grade School's own website, and of course even sites like ours, and get some of that information.
We are talking about the state of education here in Indiana. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Connie, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
I volunteered in an inner city school a couple of years ago, several afternoons a week, the same classroom. Was a very good teacher, to see why third grade students were having so much trouble passing their iReads test. And I was astounded at how many children in the room had issues, learning problems, behavioral problems that put them on IEP programs. The number on meds were, a percentage that was hard to believe. And I realized at the end of the year when they took the test that the children on the IEP programs didn't have the same standards as all of the children. So that in the fourth grade, when they started the school year, the fourth grade class had the students who had clearly passed the third grade reading test and the IEP students. And the only students who were repeating the third grade were the ones that technically had been expected to pass that test. Anyway, the charter schools, I know, take some students on IEP programs, but they don't take them all, because one of the real charges within the inner city neighborhood where I volunteered was that the students often go into a charter school until after the funding is assigned, and then the charter school may dismiss a student for whatever reason, and they end up back in the public schools. So the inner city public schools have this incredible, incredible task of dealing with students with so many learning problems. I was at the library a couple of weeks ago. I believe Mr. Elliott was the person who led the discussion. I was really surprised to see two candidates for the IPS board who worked at charter schools. I wondered if there was actually some kind of conflict of interest. I believe one of the candidates actually won. Anyway, as an education reporter, it would interest me how he sees this issue of why the charter schools don't face the same standards in accepting these students with learning problems.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Connie. Scott.
Yes.
Sure. So let me start out by making it clear. It is illegal for a charter school to turn you away, turn a child or a family away because the student is on an IP or disabled or needs special education services or any of those things. That violates the law. If you're aware of a situation like that, you should bring that to the attention of State Department of Education, school board, the school itself, that they're in violation of the law. Now, that just because that is illegal does not mean it does not happen. And here's the where I think the problem occurs most often is schools. A lot of charter schools have a particular sort of approach or philosophy or instructional style, and sometimes they and also they often run on a tighter budget. So because of those reasons, they sometimes don't equip up with all of the same special ed services that that a public school district has. So as an example, I wrote about, this is actually not a charter school, but this is Arlington High School, which is in state takeover, is run by a charter school. And I wrote a story there 2 years ago about how on January 1st, a profoundly disabled student walked in or was brought in the front door by her family, by his family. And the school had to hire people and purchase equipment, and it ended up being very expensive to serve that student, but they did. Mm-hmm. So that's what should happen. But I think what happens often is that the schools will, when they're being the schools that are well-intentioned, will tell the parents, hey, we need to let you know, like, we are not as robust in our ability to serve your child as you might get elsewhere. And schools that are ill-intentioned will actively discourage that family from enrolling in order to avoid those costs and or avoid the issues that the student might bring. It's a real problem. And she is right, the caller is right, that the public school, first of all, they tend to have the services, and second of all, they absolutely are the source for serving students. So they do get all those kids, period. There's no referring them anywhere else in a typical public school. So this is one of the challenges of school choice, is how to make sure everything's even and fair and that students don't get illegally turned away for any reason.
We've also gotten an email from a listener named Ann who says, it is important to preserve, even rebuild, the public school system in this country. It creates shared values among our citizens, which is important. To do away with public schools and just provide federal grants allows individuals to choose their children's schools essentially willy-nilly, with no guarantees that individuals are choosing quality educational institutions that will teach documented sciences and history rather than those subjects tailored to particular ideologies. Our public schools are important. I'm not sure. I don't think there's a question in there as much as there is a statement, but in some ways it's like when we were referencing that discussion between Luke Kenley and Bob Boehning. I mean, Kenley's argument was sort of the classic Jeffersonian one, that we invest in education as a public good, and Boehning was really saying it's a parent's responsibility. Now, to some degree, that's caricaturing both of their views, but and oversimplifying.
The philosophical divides there are real. I'll say this. I don't think there's a credible movement to do away with public schools. I think that the real question is how what are the what will ultimately prove the best way to use public funds to educate children? I think that's where most of the debate is occurring. It was interesting to listen to your emailer. I was thinking of how the some of the pro school choice folks would answer that, and I know one thing they would answer that is to point out she mentioned very correctly that if you were just give someone money and say go to any school you want, as we do at the college level, for instance, sometimes people make
bad choices. Well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like people sometimes go to colleges that are probably not very well intentioned and will run up their bills and mm-hmm. not graduate them and take their money, right? Mm-hmm. So she's right. Like extending this concept down to K-12, those kinds of dangers arise. But I think the school choice folks would quickly point out that the problem she's saying, like, will they get a quality education? Will it cover everything that's supposed to be covered? These criticisms can also be made of traditional public schools. You know, if a school has been 25% of students passing and under 50% of kids graduating for decades, and there are such schools, is that school, is that a better choice than if a student were to take a voucher and go to a high-performing private school? You know, I think that's a debate.
And if I were I think if we were to take Ann's argument, that was the emailer, and if I don't do justice to your argument, please call us at 866-476-3881 and make the argument yourself. Is really, though, you do hear this argument that what we're creating is really two different tiers of education, that that the voucher schools, the charter schools, sort of get to skim the cream, and then everything else is left just for the public schools, so that there is a segregation along perhaps not race but other demographic.
So that's a danger, a legit danger in creating these sorts of system. However, I would say certainly in Indianapolis, you just don't see that much. Really, if you look at the profile of a student in terms of their family income and their special ed status and their English language learning status and all those sorts of things, and you took the average student who attends a charter school in Indianapolis and compared it to the average student who attends IPS, they're not that different. They mm-hmm. on average, they look very similar. There may be a couple instances where there are charter schools that have some level of advantage, but then there are also magnet schools in IPS where there are very few of those kids with those disadvantages too. So at least nationally, there are some other sorts of circumstances where you do see some of that segregating along the ways you're talking, but I don't think there's much of it in Indiana today. Now that she's right, though, to raise the issue and put it on the table, because as you create these sort of choice-driven systems, you do have to worry about those kinds of effects, and that can occur.
Well, and I'm going to reframe Luke Kenley's question. What evidence do we have, or is there evidence right now, that these are working? The charter schools, vouchers, whatever.
Yeah, so let me say, this is why I love my job. Mm-hmm. This is the most interesting issue, I think. You know, what's happened in education in the last 20 years or so is really, it's changing in a way it has not changed in more than 100 years. You know, 100 years, so much less change occurred than what's occurred, 1990 to the present. Okay, so 24 years. That's the scope of my career. So we don't know how this is going to turn out. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things I love about covering this is I don't know the answers. I don't know which way works best.
Yeah,
I don't
stay in the movie theater to the very end.
Exactly, yeah. Right. It's funny, people will sometimes press me for my personal opinions on it, and I often point to my brother as a Civil War historian, and I said, no one ever asks him if he's rooting for the North or the South. You know, it's I sort of think of it the same way. I'm just totally fascinated by what's occurring here, and I don't feel a rooting interest. I'm just curious to see how it turns out and if it turns out to be good for the union or bad for the union, right? So anyway,
by union you mean North, not the teachers union in this context. We probably need to be careful
how
to
we
get
use
you
the
into,
word
get,
union.
Don't want to get you into trouble here.
So anyway, in terms of evidence, mm-hmm. There's so much evidence that you can make a credible argument in a couple different ways. Are charters working in Indianapolis? I was just reading Amos Brown's column today, and Amos was arguing that they're not working. And he was looking at the overall performance of all the charter schools in Indianapolis is not very good. They're 50%, or I think a little under 50% of the schools are rated low, a D or mm-hmm. an F, But if you look at, for instance, just the mayor chartered schools, they do a little better. So the overall county's charter schools are dragged down a little bit by the non-mayor charters. So it depends on how you look at things sometimes.
We're going to continue this. We are talking about the state of education here in Indiana. My guest is Scott Elliott, who's the founding bureau chief of Chalkbeat Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881 or send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about the state of pre-K to 12 education here in Indiana. My guest is Scott Elliott, who's the founding bureau chief of Chalkbeat Indiana. And I should say that that this program is part of the American Graduate Initiative, which is funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. American Graduate shines a spotlight on the policies and practices help children achieve success from their earliest preschool days through high school graduation and then as they transition to college and careers. You can learn more at americangraduate.org. Well, we were talking just before we went to the break and you were in the middle of a point, so I wanted to let you wrap up.
I think I did get to the end of it there. I don't honestly remember what I was talking about anymore.
Well, we started by talking about the points about whether this is being cared, and you were
working,
saying the
right.
Charter schools and the vouchers.
Yeah, so there's some evidence that of success, and there's some evidence that this might be bad policy. I think that we have yet to get definitive answers on those kinds of reforms. So that's why, hopefully organizations like mine, we're out there, three of us journalists reporting on this every day, trying to gather that evidence and help people make those decisions.
We're talking about education in Indiana here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Tom, welcome to the program. Tom?
Paul?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Paul?
Yeah, I'm Paul.
Okay, well, thank you, Paul. What's on your mind?
I was a teacher in IPS, and I was in one of the lowest performing schools in the state. At one time, I went with this staff to open a new school. They closed the original school I was in, and moved the staff to a whole new building. And when I was teaching in that second building, in fact, when I was in a previous building over 5 years, I would have classes of 35 and 40 kids. I had one class that spent the year at right at 40 to 42 kids all year long. And I think that this last year that I taught, we had, I had 125, 130 kids, and fully 70 kids were receiving special needs services of Title I services of one form or another. I think having charter schools is all well and dandy if they're all going to be held to the same accountability standards as public schools, and the teachers that, and I want to say this, that they need to be protected by the union because they're a target of administration, politicians, parents, and many times kids. Mm-hmm. That the biggest thing that this country could do to help education is to, besides pay teachers more, no more than 15 kids in a classroom, and every teacher has a classroom assistant, but nobody wants to pay any taxes in this country to do that.
Thanks very much for the call, Paul.
Yeah, I'm going to hang up now.
We'll let Scott respond. Thanks very much.
Yeah, so Paul brings up some really critical issues that are facing education in the country and, of course, here in Indiana and in the kind of classrooms he's talking about. One is there's just no denying the fact that there's been an explosion of special education over the last 20 years or so. Some of it is that we've just, as a nation, I think, become more aware of disability and we've made an effort since the federal laws protecting disabled people, not just children, but particularly children, were strengthened in the 70s. I think there's more awareness, there's more effort, and as a result, more kids are identified as having these needs. So there's no good answers to that. It's very costly. One of the reasons, you know, people often point to the explosion of what some folks have termed an explosion of budgets in schools. And they are up over since the 70s, for instance. And a big chunk of that is they're serving all these kids with special ed needs, and that's more costly. So that's a real problem that we don't have good answers to yet. And he's certainly right that we need to get better at serving those kids and figure out how to do it when they come in large numbers. The class size thing is in those are really large class sizes that he was describing. I would agree with him that school districts should certainly try to limit it from the size he was in. There's this interesting debate out there about where the right class size is. There was quite a movement for a while, particularly in the last decade or so, to get class sizes much smaller. And there's some conflicting data on whether that makes a big difference in terms of how kids achieve. There's a study a lot of people like to point to, or a couple studies that say if you're a very effective teacher, it almost doesn't matter how many kids they put in your class, that your kids will perform well. I remember describing that study to a friend of mine who I know is an outstanding teacher, and she kind of laughed at me and
said— Her eyes just kind of rolled back in her head.
Well, no, she said, that's probably true, but, like, it will be terrible.
Yeah.
She's like, my life would be terrible, and it would be difficult for the kids, and, yeah, I might get them all to do well on tests and stuff like that, but it's certainly not good. So it's interesting. That's, again, as we talked about with funding, like figuring out the right balance to that is really hard. What's the right size of a class so that it's like that if the instruction can be effective, that the management of the classroom can be effective, but that it's affordable, that the district can manage it? Those are not easy answers.
We've gotten a Facebook message from Michael. If you want to find us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. Michael says the privatization of education in Indiana is part of Republicans' long-term commitment to profiting from taxpayers while dumbing down the citizenry, which is evident every time we have an election and a majority of Hoosiers vote against their own economic interests. The charter schools are nothing more than an intentional effort to steal from the taxpayers, which is all the Republicans, conservatives ever think government is good for. Well,
there's a strong-held opinion.
Yes, strongly held.
I can tell you, it's interesting. One of the things that's been interesting for me coming from Ohio to Indiana, as I did, Ohio has quite a few for-profit charter schools.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the for-profit chains of charter schools, the children achieve at good levels. And there are some that are very concerning, that where they don't, the kids, by and large, in the chain don't seem to do very well. And there are questions about how they spend the money and whether it's being spent in the classroom appropriately. But, I point out to folks in Indiana that they're really, particularly here in Indianapolis, there are not very many for-profit charters in Indianapolis. By that, I mean charters that are run by for-profit management companies. Far less than I saw in the city as I worked in Ohio. I think that in this state, the argument that this is a profit center for somebody is not as strong as it is in other parts of the country. That broad national criticism, which is a valid one to debate, is maybe not as strong an argument in
Not
Indiana.
As much of an application here in this state. We've gotten an email, which I think is a provocative one, from a listener named Michael. And if you want to reach out to us in email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Has some nice words to say about you. He says, great program, very nonpartisan speaker. Then he asks, how are we able to give one grade to an entire school? Huh. Yes, some kids don't graduate, but some do very well. Washington High School in Indianapolis has a student at West Point and others at other high-quality universities, but it's a low-graded school. Mm-hmm. If we have one grade for an entire school, can we do that for a district, and would that lead to grading a city and state?
So this is a really tough question, and again, how many times have I said that today? This is one of the problems in education, is that the answers are not simple ever, okay? And so why do we want to put a grade on a school? The theory behind it is, help me as a parent understand the performance of the school. So, like, I can understand what an A is. I can understand what an F is. That helps me. That if my school is rated an F, the hope on that side of the fence is that it will prompt me to ask questions, to get involved, and maybe help improve the school. Okay. On the other hand, to his point, is it's really hard to boil down the total effect of a school to a five-step letter grading system. It just really is. And we had a very passionate debate on a state panel that State Superintendent Glenda Ritz led over the last year, trying to figure out how to reimagine the grading system about whether or not, for instance, there should be two grades. there was a push. By the way, Luke Kemley was one of the people who thought maybe that wouldn't be a bad idea if they used two grades, one for the absolute test performance of the school and one for the growth measure. Because what they're trying to do now is create this complicated formula that merges those and then gives one overall grade. And I think, you know, I spent most of the day yesterday at a state board meeting in which school after school after school went to the board and said, you can't treat our school the way everyone else does because we're different. Guess what? All the schools are a little different. Yeah. You know what I mean? So that's why it's hard to apply one ADEF system to everybody. It's just a really tough problem.
Well, and it was, you were saying that for some reason, that old cliche about a camel is a horse designed by a committee came to mind for whatever reason. We're talking about the state of education here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Mary, welcome to the program.
Hi. I had come up with this idea after one expert in education had said, you know, we have to think a little bit about how we educate our teachers as well. You know, should there be changes made there? And one thing that comes to mind is what I've noticed in the kindergarten, first and second grades is kids all have these disabilities and IEPs, except for they're very mild. And with some background knowledge, a general education teacher could easily deal with it. But I guess they're still being educated like they have for years and years and years. But I think it's either a K-6 or K-8 certificate. And I was thinking, since studies show that a good preschool really is the predictor of your future success, why not take some of that newer discipline of early childhood education and kind of eat up kindergarten, first, and second? Because I could definitely get more answers from the people in the pre-K situation than I could once we got to kindergarten. You know, the teachers are like, I don't know. So I thought, maybe it was that newer discipline of the early childhood education. We certainly haven't had that. That's a fairly new thing, would help.
Well, indeed.
Thanks very much for the call.
There are some policymakers in this state who agree with you. Let me name some of them. The governor of the state, the mayor of Indianapolis, the superintendent of Indianapolis, and many of the large business leaders in this city and even in the wider state strongly believe what she said, which is that there's no really debating the evidence anymore that 0 to 5 years of age is a really important time for your learning. Now, do you have to be in preschool? Depends. It depends on the resources in your home, the ability of your parents to give you everything you need to be prepared for kindergarten. In some homes, that works just fine. There are homes, though, where they're not able to give that same level and or the parents are just working and, frankly, not available a lot of the day to work with the children, or they need a place for the child to go anyway. So how can we make that experience high quality? That's a really big challenge, but she's right that if it could be done on a wide scale in an affordable way, all those things I just said that were pretty hard to get all on one page. It could really benefit a lot of kids. That's why there's such a push for it. I think the key question on preschool is how much will it cost, and what can the state afford? Where do you draw the line? Is there a way you can strike a balance that will aid kids but still be worth the money? Those are kind of the hard questions that are debated.
Karen, welcome to the program. Karen.
I wasn't expecting to be called on.
Oh, sorry. calling all the way from Munster, as I understand it.
That's correct.
Good.
I have a couple of comments. First of all, under the current school formula, Munster is increasingly being disadvantaged because we don't seem to have enough people that need to be fed lunches, or at least that's what I've been told. Our allotment on an annual basis is declining. We agreed to an additional tax last year, which has not yet been an additional assessment on our houses, which has not yet been applied to the educational system, which does not make us particularly happy. I would like to say that the metrics that are being applied here are, in my opinion, very wrong. Education is not measured like widgets. We can't decide whether or not this child is worth $43 a week or $45 or whatever. The metrics need to be designed and approved by professional educators, and that is whether or not the child is experiencing success. I don't see that being the current criteria. And when you've got privatization going on, the underlying thing is going to be profitability, which is not, in my opinion, anywhere close to the proper function for education. And the last thing I'd like to say is that there is an organization named Indiana Coalition for Public Education, headed or at least involving Tony Lux and other superintendents who have had experience in public education in the past with successful careers and who are very much opposed to the direction we're headed in now. I would suggest that people who are incensed about what's going on Google that, Indiana Coalition for Public Education. Thank you for letting me spout off.
Certainly. Thanks very much for the call, Karen.
Okay, Scott. Bye.
So she brings up, I think, another issue we haven't talked about, which is another sticky one in education.
Well, we could do like 5 hours here.
I was just going to say a word or two about measurement. She was saying that measures we have now are not giving us good information about where kids are. So, what's funny thing is if you go talk to, first of all, the word amuses me, but the person, the name of the scientist who creates standardized tests is called a psychometrician, which I always just, I just find that name kind of amusing. So if you talk to psychometricians, it's so funny to talk to them because they will tell you stuff like, I'll ask them like, hey, can Indiana's third grade reading test tell me whether or not a kid can read? No. Oh, okay. What does it tell you? Tells you how they compare to other kids on this particular instrument. Like the test creators themselves will tell you to be careful about what assumptions you make about what kids can or cannot do based on how they score on a test.
Which is interesting because that really, when we talk about accountability all too often in these education conversations, we are talking about standardized testing,
right,
how the kids stack up.
Standardized testing is not always a great tool at answering the big question that we want to know, the one that your caller just described, which is like, for instance, is this child ready to graduate? Are they ready for college? Are they ready for life? Will they be effective in a job? So every psychometrician in the world will tell you like any state test won't answer those questions, right? But that's because we just don't have the instrument that can tell you that. We're doing the best with what we got in terms of the standardized tests. But now here's something that you should remember is that one thing standardized tests are quite good at is telling you something about how kids compare to each other. Okay, it can't always answer, is this kid ready for X or whatever? But it can tell you when of this set of kids that took the test, your kid was on the low end, your kid was on the high end, your kid's at the very bottom, your kid's at the very top. Whether or not that's exactly precise in telling you like your kid is in danger or your kid is just fine, that's a little bit going too far. But it should raise your questions in your mind about what your kid's needs are based on the general area of where they land.
That probably is going to have to be the last word. I would say to our listeners, though, if they want to continue this kind of conversation, you've got a couple of public conversations at the library coming up on November 17th, talking about testing, and December 9th, talking about teaching. You're moderating both of them.
That's correct. Those will be really good.
And if you are listening and would like to continue the conversation, you can do so at our website, WFYI.org. I am John Kroll. I'd like to thank my guest, Scott Elliott of Chalkbeat, Indiana. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.